Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You are listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. Our phone number here at the station is 760-337-8874. And I'm your host, Maria Wyatt, with co-host Scott Dudley.
Good morning and welcome.
And just to give a really quick info for Valleyites, if you take Austin Road, it's closed. From Evan Hughes to Ayton Road, it's closed. So do not take that road.
Unless you're listening to the podcast, in which case probably...
You're too late, and you probably got to work late, so...
This is Let's Talk About It, your voice for radio wellness, and indeed, there are only 2 days left before the Relay for Life celebration of Southwest High School, and your chance to see Los Outpatients perform for free at 6:30 p.m., so circle that on your calendar and come out and see a band that's peaking.
And for a good cause.
Peeking out from under the covers.
Yeah. And also for the good cause, Relay for Life for cancer, so... What time again?
They're going to start 6:30 p.m. on Saturday evening at Southwest High School in the back out by the track.
Good.
And we'll see you all out there. Say you heard about it on Let's Talk About It, and they'll dedicate a song to you. That we can handle. All right, good morning. Hey, our guest today is Marty Kritze, and he's the Chief Probation Officer, the Chief Probation Officer for the County of Imperial. Marty, good morning. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show, and... Let's jump into this world.
Good morning, Maria, Scott. Glad to be here.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. But I hear I had a couple staff in here yesterday that set the bar pretty high, and so the pressure's on.
Yes, it is. I was listening to the Spanish show, and Jennifer and Terry gave really good information.
But we got the chief.
Put
that out.
Well, they do all the work. And they do a really good job, so I'm very proud of them.
Yeah, Jennifer does the adult population, and Terry does the adolescents, or the youth, the minors.
So let's start out with the scope of what probation does for the county. And then maybe later on in the show we can talk about how we've had to grow with the times and where we're going, and in the context of California, what we got to do.
I know.
How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right.
Our basic mission in the criminal justice system is a number of things. Is because it's really separated by the divisions that we have. We have adult and juvenile, and we provide information to the courts. Judges are sentencing both adults and juveniles, and they want to have reliable, verified information in front of them to be able to make informed decisions. So we have staff who gather that information and organize it in a report and ultimately provide the courts with recommendations that they rely on very heavily and follow frequently. The other part of our mission is to those individuals that the courts feel are a safe risk to be released into the community and be supervised under conditions of probation. We have staff who are assigned to supervise them, which we do, and the majority of them are successful in their supervision, but those who are not successful, we are charged with bringing those folks back in front of the court and providing the court with more information as to how they did on supervision. Just because someone's failed in one particular area of their supervision, oftentimes the court gives them another chance to try it again, and sometimes people get multiple chances. But those who are ultimately not very successful, or they're committing new crimes while on probation, the recommendation ends up to be that their probation be revoked, and they ultimately go to state prison. We also do some victim services work with our victim witness advocacy program. We try to do prevention. Those are our core functions.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole, I think the main premise that I kind of want to get out is the whole industry of probation is gone over a fairly significant change, particularly in California, or most recently in California, in the last, I want to say, 7 to 8 years. And where I'm going with that is there was a lot of research that has come out. It's called evidence-based practices, and a model of that is called Principles of Effective Intervention has been published. And so I think the general public thinks that nothing works,
mm-hmm.
and that's just not true because we now have a body of work, and it's not just one research study. It's called a meta-analysis. It's a lot of research, and I kind of like to use the example of I think everyone now realizes that medical problems like heart attack,
mm-hmm.
that there are certain risk factors to for
prevention.
For prevention, and that could be, you know, if you smoke or if you have a sedentary lifestyle, your diet, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And I think for the most part, people have accepted that research is true, with the mm-hmm. exception of maybe, you know, some of the research mm-hmm. that was done by tobacco companies saying that smoking wasn't that bad for you. So, but there's a body of work that balances that people readily accept that if we have 100 people here and we determine their risk factors, we can pretty much with pretty good accuracy tell you who of those 100 are for risk for heart attack. The same is true for criminal offenders and being able to predict those who are risk for recidivism. And for a fairly long time, how probation approached offenders was if we had 1,000 of them and we had 10 probation officers, we just
did the math.
Yeah.
Did the math.
Divided them up.
Did
you know.
Them out. And
divided
up. What this research is saying is not all offenders are created equal. They have different levels of risk, and probation really needs to focus its resources and its attention on those higher risk offenders.
Is the financial cost of things like probation and the correctional system in general, is that like the mother of necessity here? I mean, do you think that it would have just kept kind of going along at its own pace had not there been some additional competition for funding, had not people started looking at the long-term costs of housing, you know, large numbers of people in chronically revolving systems?
Deficit in the California budget?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what occurred was the researchers were trying to determine how can we address criminal behavior? Is there ways that we can reduce recidivism? And what they found out is, yes, that's true. And one of the byproducts of that was there can be substantial financial savings to local governments by mm-hmm. doing that in a number of different areas where you have less people going to... You can have, if you're successful on probation, say we are able to stop that revolving door
mm-hmm.
and we're able mm-hmm. to get people to change their behavior, a lot less people are filling our county jails and our state prisons, which have the higher end in terms of costs mm-hmm. when it comes to sanctions that the court can impose. And I don't know the exact figures, but... And it varies from county to county. But just for a day in the county jail, it may be, you know, anywhere from $60 to $80. On the juvenile side, it might be in the hundreds.
You know, I went on Travelocity. I got a county jail day for $24.99.
That's pretty cheap. You probably didn't eat.
Is that enough buy-in for all of the partners to say, hey, let's commit to the investment of this, or are systems kind of reluctant sometimes?
Well, I can tell you what is happening right now, what you're reading in the newspapers about realignment and what's occurring and how it's going to affect the criminal justice system and public safety. Is what they're proposing is that there are a certain class of offender who can no longer go to prison. They're going to be housed mm-hmm. in the local county jails, and the local county jails and probation are to develop programs to try to address whatever needs that they have.
In other words, the state wants outcomes.
The state wants outcomes, and but they are also looking for how can we lower our $26 billion deficit, and we're going to push these programs down to the counties, and we're going to give them funding, and our concern is it going to be the appropriate level of funding mm-hmm. that we need in order to build the capacity to provide those services to those populations. The other piece to that realignment plan is... again, carving out a population of parolees that are coming out of the mm-hmm. prisons who are no longer going to be paroled by, be supervised by state parole. They'll be paroled. They'll be supervised by probation.
Mm-hmm. County.
County. And those parolees will no longer go through a state parole board process in the event that there's a violation or a revocation process. That revocation process will then go back to the court, similarly what we do with probationers. So, you know, that is the realignment plan, and really the basic premise to that realignment plan is if you fund probation properly and we operate probation properly under the guise of evidence-based practice, we can improve our outcomes, which is what the taxpayers mm-hmm. want, and we can do it for less cost, which I think the taxpayers want too.
All right, you're listening to KUBO Radio. Let's talk about it. Our phone number is 337-8874. We're here with Marty Crete. He's the Chief Probation Officer of the County of Imperial, and we're talking about paradigm change. Boy, you know, it's almost been... so long that term's been used that it's time for a new word for paradigm change, frankly. But that's what this is.
I mean,
in lots of levels.
And it's been going on, I mean, across the counties here in the state. I mean, I know that in L.A. County, they have, you know, we provide behavioral health, we provide functional family therapy. In L.A., they provide functional family probation, where probation officers are the ones that are providing the therapy to the family. I mean, wow. That's something that... you don't hear that. If they go out there and they do...
That's out of the box and off the shelf and not even in the store.
But it's out there.
It's like an iPhone 2.
No, they're moving. An iPad 2 also.
You know, just to give you a historical perspective, and I don't know what the answer is to this situation, but for unfortunately, California has been one of the last states to really recognize and adopt evidence-based practice. It's now actually in a law, which is Senate Bill 678, which is a Community Corrections Incentive Act. But, you know, there are states like that really are at the forefront of implementing evidence-based practices that come to mind are Kansas, Iowa, even the state of Texas, which, you know,
those are really progressive states.
Well, Texas has a reputation.
Typically first in the nation in terms of adopting new, exciting
sure.
practices.
Not really. But they are on the forefront. But, you know, areas like New York and California, which you think they are, they're probably some of the last ones to adopt that. You know, I think what's significant is Texas. Texas, much like California, invested heavily in prisons. Out of all the states in the country, they take their criminal justice pretty mm-hmm. seriously. They kill people
every day. But it's still like the old West right there.
It is, but they've probably provided more funding for community corrections in the last 4 years than any state in the union. So California is adopting that. It's been slow. Speaking to my peer chief probation officers, this has not been easy to implement because of it. It's such a shift in the paradigm. A lot of probation departments were built under the enforcement model, which is, we really are looking out to catch people doing something wrong and bring them back in front of the court, which resulted in a lot of probationers going back to prison for a probation violation. Mm-hmm. And so this new 678 bill is saying, you know what, we think that if we fund you better, you're going to be able to improve your outcomes. Less people are going to go to prison. And so that's our challenge, and it's been a challenge. All the counties in the state of California are in the process of rolling out evidence-based practice, and the engine that drives that whole process is risk needs instruments. Mm-hmm. And, I think the response to that has been a little mixed. I think some staff embrace that. Others see it as
more paperwork.
Challenge. It is more paperwork, but it's a challenge to their years of experience and what they know about people and what their gut is. But it's not meant to replace that. It's meant to supplement that. Mm. And it's also to really sort the population to high risk, medium risk, and low risk. And
have some sort of prescriptive focus for each of those levels?
Yes.
And some not having focus at all, because we really need to focus on the higher risk, not the highest risk, the higher risk. When I say highest risk is those folks at the highest end of our continuum, they aren't really candidates for this behavior change model that we're trying to adopt. We know that they are going to have very difficult time changing their behavior, so they're really candidates for surveillance and enforcement model. When you ratchet it down to people who show the capacity to learn and change, those are the people that we want to focus on.
It's like our intervention model.
Exactly.
You do intervention with a couple of, a couple of therapy sessions or something, you can change that behavior. But going back to the high risk or highest risk, what kind of people are you looking at? What kind of crimes have they committed?
Those folks that are on the highest continuum of risk, it may not necessarily be serious crimes, but it could be just a lot of them. But we do have some people who, it's kind of interesting. I recently had a long conversation with a judge about someone who was low risk, but committed a very, very serious crime. And those happen. And even though someone may score low risk on an instrument, the bottom line is that our laws and our society demands that crime be punished. So incarceration and maybe a long-term incarceration or very intensive supervision coupled with incarceration and punishment is required. So there's just...
Is there a risk that our existing system of looking at certain crimes as being the punishable ones overrides parts of this system? I mean, I can, in my head, perhaps think of, I don't know, sexual crimes against minors jumps out as something that, well, I don't care what you scored, you need some sort of punishment there. But could that list populate itself and say, well, okay, those people and, people who sell drugs and, people who, do whatever. And pretty soon you've got the same list of people you always had.
No, I think that's being limited to violent offenders, whether it was of a sexual nature. When you have people who, are coming through the system for, taking someone's life or, you know, being involved in sophisticated grooming of victims in a sexual mm-hmm. nature. Those, I think people agree, require a punitive response.
Yeah, politically there's a little challenge here because, I mean, it's always been, what was the Willie Horton, whatever that guy's mm-hmm. name was. It's you know, if we adopt this new model, the first time it doesn't work correctly with somebody of lower risk, quote-unquote, the people who were elected in that area are going to take the heat of the politics of, well, look what they're doing.
That's probably every probation officer's fear and nightmare. And, you know, that's something that everyone needs to know right out of the chute is, you know, we do these risk instruments that are actuarial based. So it's based on the same premise mm-hmm. as when you buy life insurance. You know, the insurance company is...
They're taking a risk.
They're using these same kinds of principles to determine is we're betting on you that...
You're going to live
till X amount of time, but that doesn't always happen.
Sure, it's like a Justin Verlander fastball. I mean, most of the time, it ain't going to get hit. And then occasionally, somebody's going
to
rip it.
And you know what? We are going to have a low-risk offender commit a very serious crime. You know, even though if we have all the best laid plans in terms of supervision, where we feel that we're on top of somebody and we have a track history of providing excellent supervision, that case can go awry too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like the mental health parallel where somebody can come in with fairly fairly mild types of mental health problems. And that person may eventually have some very serious things happen.
Yes, that's true.
No doubt about it.
We do that. Yeah, that happens.
Even with exactly prescribed treatment. So you run into that risk.
Yep.
How do you handle that? How do you sell that in a world where, I mean, the politics of fear basically has been a very effective tool for a long time?
Well, we just try to educate people. One of the things that we did with trying to, part of our approach, you know, first of all, we reconstituted our mission statement to include that we are a public safety agency and that we, how we're going to meet that mission is we are focusing on trying to initiate behavior change for a long-term solution. And that we are going to hold people accountable to those court orders.
That involves a lot of training.
That's the first part. And you know, staff participated in modifying our
mission statement. So old school, was like just say no, right? I mean, kind of the mentality.
Some of that. But the other part is you have a constituency out there called John Q. Public, who funds this operation. And we've had, I believe, three different stakeholder groups. And, you know, I have to admit, I would have liked to have, and maybe this is something that we can do in the future, is really focus on the public. But we had stakeholder groups be invited to hear about these kinds of things, of what the changes that we're trying to make. And those stakeholder groups involve judges, elected officials, chiefs of police, behavioral health, Department of Social Services, schools, providers, and just tried to walk them through that we're moving more from an enforcement, strict enforcement base to a behavior change base because we think we in the long term will have better outcomes.
What was your response to your stakeholders? How were they when they hear this? Because they share the problem, the social responsibility dealing with difficult people,
and sometimes the same people. We're dealing with the same people.
Indeed.
To tell you the truth, it's been very positive. I didn't out of those three different groups, and I want to say that there were, you know, well over 100 people across those three different groups, and I had no one come up to me and say, you know what, that's just a bunch of bull. Because I believe people recognize that. And the very talented people that we had making the presentations had credibility. And I think using some of those analogies about the medical model, people can relate to, and it's the same premises. We have this mountain of research that says, if you do these things with this group of people, and you do it with fidelity, you can have successful outcomes. And I don't think you can really argue against that. I mean, that is the evidence. So I think it gives people hope. I think some of the people who you would think would be against it has kind of been supportive, very supportive. I've had a couple police chiefs here locally who said, you know what, I learned a lot through this presentation. This is the second time I sat through this presentation, and it just makes sense. Getting back to some of the previous things we talked about, the old way that we used to do probation is, I mentioned that we have 1,000, we separate, we just carve them up and send them to each probation officer, and now we're doing it by risk, level of risk based on an assessment. Is the research also shows is those people who are at the lower end of the continuum in terms of risk, you really don't have to be spending a whole lot of time with them, because some of them have just been so impressed by being arrested, having to go through a court process, you really don't have to provide any intensive interventions. In fact, there's a lot of research that shows that if you do impose or expose low-risk offenders, both adult and juvenile, to intensive interventions, it actually shows it. They perform worse. Their outcomes are worse.
And this is based on data.
On data, it's similarly with the other part of the research that we've learned is that we probably participated unwittingly in the past is, we have people who have substance abuse issues, and we would just make referrals to substance abuse programs without taking into consideration what their risk level is to reoffend. And so we may have groups being run that have high-risk offenders with low-risk offenders, and
We call that mentoring.
In a negative way.
And to our detriment, because what we have learned, what occurs is those low-risk people are not having a positive effect on the high-risk people. It's just the opposite. The high-risk people have an effect on those low-risk people to where...
The dark side of the force.
It decreases our likelihood of having successful outcomes with those... people.
Marty, it's the top of the hour. We're going to take a short break. This is Let's Talk About It, sponsored by Imperial County Behavioral Health. We're here with the professor, Chief Professor Marty Kurtze. We're going to come back and look at more at how this works for our community.
You're listening to the complete podcast version of Imperial County's Behavioral Health Service, Let's Talk About It, brought to you by KXOradio.com.
You are still listening to Let's Talk About It, your weekly wellness radio, and we are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. And a reminder, our phone number here at the station is 337-8874. And if you missed the first half, or you're listening to this again, remember you can access this segment on our podcast at kxoradio.com.
Yeah, we'd never really listened to the second half of the song, and we wondered how it ended. So.
Yes.
But we're back.
We finally saw it. It's a good song, Maya, after all these years.
337-8874 is the phone number. I'm Scott. She's Maria. We're here today with Chief Probation Officer Marty Kurtze, and we're talking about the science of probation, the way to make something as efficacious, which is effective and fast and cheap all at the same time. And it's a fascinating conversation.
The future, the present of a probation department.
And this morning, I think in the first half hour, we kind of, well, I focused on, you know, a piece that is considered the risk, and that's who should we be really focusing our attention on, and that's the higher risk population. Not that we're not going to do some things with our moderate and lower risk. We're just not going to be doing as much, and we're not going to focus as much of our resources on those folks. The other piece of this is what is commonly referred to as the need principle, and that is the what, is what do you do with this higher risk population in order to have better outcomes. And one thing that the reason why we implement or trying to implement these assessment tools flesh out different factors or criminogenic needs, that the research says if you target these particular areas, you'll improve the likelihood of reducing recidivism and improving your outcome. And I think the general public does have a misconception, because I periodically run into folks and have a conversation about what I do for a living, and you know, kind of the common misconception is, you know, if you just give somebody a job and they can support their family, and if they have substance abuse issues, if you just get them in some substance abuse counseling, they'll be just fine. And what we've learned in the research is that those two factors are considered criminogenic needs, but they're not the most significant. Mm-hmm. And some of the highest, and you know what, I've done a couple of exercises, kind of a test, on a number of different groups where I've been asked to speak to where I'll ask the crowd, please quick write down what you think are the top four risk criminogenic factors that predict someone committing new crimes.
337-8874. You call up with those four, and I'll give you the coffee cup in my car.
And one of those groups of people was all the chief probation officers in the state of Arizona. Another, there was actually a study.
Where they and they take law enforcement seriously.
Oh yeah, on file.
And there was another. There was actually a research study that was done in the state of Ohio where they asked that same question of hundreds of people, administrators, who were in charge of facilities and community corrections, and not one single person.
So what are the top four?
What are the top?
Risks?
Yes.
Well. One of them is kind of common sense, and I'd be willing to bet that your parents told you this one at a very early age, is who you hang around with does make a difference. So if you hang around with...
Stop picking your nose with sexually.
No, if you hang around with folks who
are
antisocial, so you, if you have antisocial associates, that is a risk factor. Very significant. You know, the other kind of common sense one is if you have a history of antisocial behavior. History is, you know, what you've done before is a pretty good predictor of your future. So those are the first two.
Marty, hit me up with a list of antisocial definers so that everybody out there can say, oh, check off, check off, check off, check off. What do you mean by antisocial? What are we talking about?
Well, when it comes to, say, antisocial attitudes, you know, it's how you view the world, your value system, is why would I go work for minimum wage when I can sell bags of pot?
Get
I can make
yeah.
more in one transaction than you can make in a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's a value system that is criminal thinking.
What about...
So they're right, but they're wrong,
yeah.
basically.
No, I would say, yeah, what about, you know, just read that a lot of people cheat on their taxes.
Those are integrity issues, you know, and that is also a piece of antisocial attitudes, antisocial personalities. Those are folks that you come across who have very poor impulse control.
Are we talking like bullies and stuff? Is that a
place
to start?
Yeah,
that can be, you know, folks who have a very difficult time walking in your moccasins. They don't have the ability to empathize for others. You know, they have poor insight into themselves as to, you know, walk me through your thought process as to why you chose to do this. And they have very poor insight. So you have antisocial attitudes, antisocial associates, antisocial personality, and a history of those antisocial acts. Those are the top four. Those are the recipe.
Wow.
Those are the kind of factors that we're looking at that we see in our highest risk. Mm-hmm. And those are the factors that we have to try to address when we develop a case plan and a supervision strategy. The research also shows, well, before I go into that, is there are other criminogenic needs that are very common, like substance abuse, family relationships, employment and education achievement, how we choose to use our leisure time is another factor. So when we have a probationer and we've done an assessment, and our assessment tells us which of those criminogenic needs are really operating here, we want to have a case plan and an approach that address those factors. And what the research is also showing is that in order to have an effect on reducing future criminal behavior, we need to address at least four of those criminogenic needs.
So, for example, from listening from yesterday's radio show, you know, we were informed, you know, that there's a lot of kids from Calexico who are coming from good families. You know, they're just both parents at home, good grades, and transporting drugs. That's the first time. First offense, no other offenses, previous offenses. So with that, for that, you know, having parents having jobs, both parents at home, both, you know, no problems at home, student never had problems at school, good grades. So that would be a low risk.
It could
depending
be,
depending on the assessment tool.
It could be because we don't want to just focus all of our attention on those risk and criminogenic needs. They're important. We also balance those with what we call protective factors.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that those items that you just mentioned,
the family.
Like a supportive family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to have two parents in the home. It can be one parent in the home that is very, very supportive. Having high academic achievement is a great protective factor. If you have kids who are dialed into school activities, sports, clubs, those are other protective factors that balance those risks. And so those particular kids who are involved in that activity, you have to think a lot of that is driven by, you know, economics. And it kind of boils down to is what kind of sanction is to be imposed for that particular crime. And judges have a difficult job having to balance those kind of factors that are going on. Do we want kids going across the border and, you know, smuggling, you know, pounds of cocaine and, you know...
We do not, and
that's a very serious offense.
Yeah, absolutely. 337-8874 is the phone number, KUBO. Let's talk about it. We're here with Chief of Probation Marty Gutte, and we're going through the reasons of the new probation, how it works, where we go,
We should say that the new probation.
You like that?
Yeah.
Brave
new probation. Well, it's probation based on research, and it's really determining who we should be focusing our attention on, what should we be focusing our attention on, and how do we go about
it. So
that?
Is there a formalized assessment process now for people entering the probationary system, adults or kids or whatever?
On our juvenile side, we've implemented a risk instrument. It's through a company called Assessments.com. It's the PACT. It's the Positive Achievement Change Tool. We've had a number of different training sessions. We've had refreshers. I believe staff are coming into a period of where they're going to be doing reassessments because our business rules say we're going to do one at the front end.
Yeah.
We're going to do one at
build yourself a database.
In 180 days. And so on the adult side, in fact, our initial training is Monday. We're having 4 days of training split into two groups. That's how I'm going to be spending my Monday and Tuesday, is learning to administer the STRONG, which is our adult version, through assessments.com. That's another, you know, I may be digressing here, but that's another kind of difference that we're seeing in making California unique, is there is no umbrella oversight agency for probation. So you have 58 counties, you have 58 versions of probation. And so we've chosen to implement the PACT and the STRONG for assessment, and we're in a region of the Southern California probation departments, and there are probably three or four other instruments being implemented by other counties. I know the Parole and San Diego County is implementing the COMPASS. Orange County implemented an instrument that was based in Wisconsin years ago that I used as a probation officer back in 1982. So it makes it difficult to, you know, to go with other counties.
We weren't the biggest market here. We didn't probably get wined and dined by the instrument people, did we?
Well, actually, we are big time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, now it's a mandate, and
we have to have it. I just think
it would be more advantageous to probation as an industry if California could have adopted one instrument, which Parole did. They had the North Point COMPASS. And, you know, if we had one single database that we could, because we have people transferring in and out of different counties and from different states. And so it just provides us with different challenges.
It would be good for data on a database. You know,
no doubt about it.
Statewide.
No doubt about it. If we were going to transfer a case, we could do that through because
they wouldn't have to reassess. They'd already have your
stuff. Exactly the same, and they would have the same stuff.
And would have a equal understanding of that. Now we would copy our materials and package it and send it off, and may not be meaningful to them. They may just set that aside and start over and do a reassessment using their tool.
Well, and the other thing you lose with this is you lose any sort of cross-county comparability. You know, we can't look at other rural California counties and say, hey, look, it looks like this here, it looks like that there, if you've got different instruments.
Mm-hmm. Well, the instruments that we adopted, there are some other counties that adopted the PACT and the STRONG. In fact, there are a couple of were considered consortiums where a number of different counties got together. They got price breaks by doing that. There was advantages to them because they were contiguous counties to where they could travel,
share their data,
and they could actually share training resources.
Mm-hmm.
So if the county next door was doing a training on the PACT, we could send some people over, and we were just paying meals. For us to do that, to send those folks to, say, Kern County, we'd have to annex
San Bernardino.
We're going to have to put them in some airplanes and put them up for a couple
expensive days,
and it's much more expensive. I digressed a little bit. What I was talking about is we talked about the risk principle, which is the who, and we talked about the need principle is the what, and there's another principle called the treatment principle, and that's the how, is how do we address those criminogenic
needs.
And
that's the hardest.
It is, and but there are some breakthroughs in research that are saying that you know, some of the things that we did in the past, what is considered talk therapy, where we just, you know, we bring people in and ask them, you know,
so how do you feel today?
How do you feel today? You know, it's really kind of client-centered where, you know, what's your relationships with your brothers and sisters and your mom and your, you know, things that were...
Oh, I'm so happy you're really trying harder.
Historical significance.
Yeah.
You know, what the treatment principle is saying is you need to deal with the behavior that's happening right now, that's right in front of you, and that treatment has to be action-oriented. And I think what, you know, another challenge for probation is, too, is they're also saying is you don't necessarily have to be a PhD in order to be able to deliver these interventions. Mm-hmm. There's social learning. And social learning is based on the premises that people learn by observing others. And being an authority figure as a probation officer, the relationship you establish with someone is very important. Mm-hmm. The amount of time and how you use that time is real important. The kind of example that you present yourself, they're watching you, and it's very important. And people can learn from their probation officer. The other piece to that is a whole slew of different curriculums called cognitive-based interventions. And I guess the easiest way to explain it is we're trying to have people walk through a thought process and trying to get them to determine is where in my thinking did that decision that I make go awry, and if I was presented with that same circumstances again, how would I make it? Would I make a different decision, and how can I go about making that decision? And where the probation officer comes into play is historically, we just provided referrals and we provided advice. Now we can be the referral. Mm-hmm. We can do that intervention. We can do groups, walking offenders through a very regimented work group. And we can teach people to do and to make better decisions by having them practice. We can actually do role play. And that is just not in the probation officer's paradigm right now. That's not just something that we're very used to, that we're going to be training our staff to do.
Typically, it was probation officers, like you said, it was, you know, the probationers to see what they were doing wrong, arrest them, put them in juvenile hall, put them in county jail. Now the probation officer is becoming more like a social worker, more like a coach.
All of those. And I think the term that we're trying to use is a change agent.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, we recognize that there are opportunities with the right individuals. If we target the right people with the right interventions and we do it the right way, we can improve those outcomes to where they change their behavior and they're not committing new crimes.
So
and that's our contribution to public safety. That means
that's
there's
your
less
mission.
There's less victims.
Yep.
So you're not probation officers. I mean, they instill a fear. Let's scare them. You know, the whole like concept of scared straight. That is no longer
that part. You know. Well, you know what?
Because even parents goes, I want you to come and talk to my kid and scare him.
You know, there's research that shows that scared straight programs do not improve outcomes. Wilderness programs do not improve outcomes. Shaming programs where we have someone sit on a corner with a sign saying, you know, I stole bubble gum from this store, does not improve outcomes. Now, those were popular at one time, and fortunately, we've had some rigorous research done on those, and we're moving away from those. We're moving into these areas where, you know, we're requiring offenders to really look at their behavior and how do you take responsibility and accountability for your behavior. You're going to do the hard work and the heavy lifting on how you go about changing that behavior. To a certain degree, you know, the focus has changed from the probation officer doing all the talking to let's try to elicit information and listen real hard to what that offender is telling us. And we use these motivational interviewing techniques, which staff have been trained on, to try to elicit that information from offenders. And I make no bones about this, we've made the probation officer's job a lot more difficult than it was 10 years ago. I've said all along, it's not real hard to catch somebody doing something wrong. You know, we can have someone urinate in a bottle, send it to a lab, it comes back dirty, you're in violation of probation, you're going to jail. But getting people to recognize that they have a substance abuse problem and working with them to work through those issues to a point where someone gets clean and they're not relying on those substances again and they're being a good example to their children and they're stopping that cycle of recidivism, that's hard work. And, you know, a lot of our staff at the probation department are embracing the opportunity to do that and are on the front end of this. And so I'm real excited about the prospect. It's just not something that's going to happen overnight. We have a strategic plan that says 5 years. It may take 10. And as long as we're all, you know, moving forward, whether it's baby steps, it's a lot, you know, organizations are very similar in terms of being in a stage of change as to how you move forward. And so our organization is moving forward, and I look forward to coming back to tell you about all the fantastic improvements and outcomes that we've had over the next couple
and
years.
And I'm looking forward because, you know, we have the same people. We're dealing with the same minors with my program through the WASP program. And, you know, just having the probation officer and the mental health rehab tech working with the same interventions, and it could make our job much easier.
Maria, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I would be remiss not to. That is another evidence-based principle, is we can't do this in a vacuum. Probation officers can't do this alone. There has to be collaboration. You have to use assets that are in the natural communities. You know, it sounds cliche-ish of it takes a village. It really does. And the more we link these services, the better communications that these services have with one another, the more our probation officers participate in some of the things that we see in our everyday, like MDTs that we do with placement, and we're starting to do that with our Evening Learning Center population. Mm-hmm. Maybe that even has to happen at the basic, you know, we have a high-risk probationer who's dialed into a couple of different services. We need to have those people in the same room maybe once a month, and we're staffing cases so we're all on the same page and we're sharing the same treatment approach or intervention approach or case plan or supervision strategy, however you want to call it. But I think that's really the future of what we – that's the now and the future of – I think we need to refine that.
All right. That's what we're going to do next year when we call you back. We ran through this hour already.
I know.
It went by fast.
It did. We appreciate coming aboard.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a great opportunity, and I look forward to working with you professionally here locally and with my staff. appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
Great. And for everybody who heard the show today and wants to share it with anybody else, it's going to be up on podcast on KXLRadio.com. So you've been immortalized,
yes,
sir.
And I already warned him.
Thank you for listening today to Let's Talk About It, and have a great weekend.
Yes. And I'll see you, for me, my part, in 3 weeks. I'll be back.
Nice.
I know.
Have a fun time.
Yes, I will.
Bye-bye, all.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.